I'm here today with Dr. Zeidel, who is a professor and researcher at UCLA. Could you tell me a little bit? Thank you. Could you tell me a little bit about what you do here?
Right. So I'm a professor in the psychology department. I'm a part of the, you know, we in the psychology department we have different areas. So I'm part of the behavioral neuroscience area and the cognitive area. We have a cognitive science program that is common to both, and students can major in that as part of the PhD. In addition to being in an area, they also can specialize in cognitive neuroscience. So that's my area.
And we've been talking a bit about your research, but what sort of things are you interested in, and what do you do?
It's easier to say what I'm not interested in, it seems. But I'm interested in anything that has to do with cognition. I actually focus on the two sides of the brain and how they interact. Now, I rationalize that interest. That's because I did that for my PhD and so on. But I rationalize that interest because I say that anything that can be, any question in psychology that is interesting can be recast in the context of hemispheres. Mm-hmm. And the most important issue is the issue of modularity. I mean, how does the brain work, right? I mean, one idea is that the brain works as a whole. Solve the problem. Any problem is solved using the same general problem solver. You feed the input, and you get the output. How does it solve it? By means-ends analysis. You know, it goes one step at a time, maybe backwards. So if I have the solution, what step before that would I need so I could get to it? And you make the distance smaller and smaller, and you solve the problem. In 1950s, they were trying to do that at Carnegie Mellon, Carnegie Tech at that time. In artificial intelligence, that was the approach. Then it became clear it's not going to work. You have different modules that do different things. Cognitive psychologists became aware of that, and computer scientists became aware of that. And neuroscience has been talking about that for a while. So we have different chunks of pieces of machinery that do different things in the mind. How do they maintain their independence? How do they interact? That's the big question. And the two hemispheres seem to me to be a really interesting model of that. Because each one it's a very interesting model. It's not a simple model. And the reason is that, you know, the definition of a module by philosopher, you know, like Fodor, you know, modularity, you know, of mind, philosopher, linguist, psychologist, I'm not sure what Fodor is, but he is all of those. He defined the module in very, very strong terms, very strict terms. I mean, it has to be domain specific, it has to be innate, it has to be hardwired, it has to be to have its own developmental course, it has to be automatic. It cannot operate, it doesn't have access to the rest of the cognitive system. The rest of the cognitive system doesn't have access to it inside, just input output. That's how they communicate. And he claimed that language is that. Well, grammar is that. Chomsky's view is that, you know, grammar is that. Mm-hmm. Is a module. Now, and faces are a module and so on. But I think that's too strong. So I think that constraint is much too strong. I think that systems can be sometimes independent, sometimes not. And they can be more or less independent. And that's where the hemispheres are really useful. Because each one, it seems to be a really fairly complete cognitive system. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing result, actually. Each hemisphere is a fairly complete cognitive system.
And these modules are distributed into one hemisphere or another, and
yes.
That affects sort of the...
Yes, exactly. So different distribution of the modules occurs in the two hemispheres. It's even more interesting, I think. It turns out some hints that the modularity of the right hemisphere is not as modular as the left. That it is the representation of the same function. Sometimes the same function is represented in both hemispheres, more distributed in the right than in the left. So if you have a bunch of right brain damage patients and a bunch of left brain damage patients, when you look at that ability, several examples, they have about the same deficit sometimes. But the right brain damage, you cannot localize the deficit in a particular part of language-gifted cortex. It's a linguistic function. It's anywhere in language-gifted cortex. So any damage anywhere will impair any of these abilities to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
In the left hemisphere, specific ones in very specific parts, much more localized. And I think that hints about how the right hemisphere works. It's a bit more associative, you know, looks at general relationships rather than it synthesizes, it doesn't analyze, you know, stuff like that. And we have anatomical evidence for that, some physiological evidence, and lots of behavioral evidence. So,
Do you think that gives any advantage? Why not distribute everything, or... Why not modularize everything?
which is stupid everything or modularize everything. So each one has an advantage and disadvantage, right?
But then to divide it specifically by hemisphere, why do that?
I think sometimes they're complementary. One idea is that one is top down, one is bottom up, for example. You can do both.
Mm-hmm.
Why should you do one or the other? And so, suppose you have a really important problem to solve. You need to solve it. But if you make a mistake, you're going to pay dearly. You want to make sure you're making the right decision. You come up with the right solution. You want to check your response. If you're like me, you make mistakes all the time. So you want to make sure that you did it again. So I add up the numbers in my checkbook. I know I'm going to make a mistake. So I do it again. If I do it again the same way, I'll make an error again, the same error again, possibly. Mm-hmm. So I do it backwards, right, or something. Do it two different ways at the same time. In fact, if you have, think of the following example. It's not a real one. I haven't tested this one. But suppose you want to know how to spell a word, right? Onomatopoeia. So, how do you spell onomatopoeia? I let my right hand try.
Uh-huh.
I look at it and I say, doesn't look right. Try again. Yeah, that's it. Let me give you a scenario. The right hand, the left hemisphere, generates the guess. The right hemisphere, which is good at pattern recognition, maybe, says it doesn't look right. It does bottom up, top down. It doesn't. It could not generate it bottom mm-hmm. up. But it, once it's there, it can tell. You
check,
know,
yeah.
Check, yeah. And then it says no, and it says no, and then it says yeah. So here's a way for the two hemispheres to complement each other, not only in processing, which we have examples for, but in control, in monitoring.
I think that's a really good example, because that sort of explains why a more diffuse look that your right brain would give at it is actually beneficial. So you have this definitive method of forming the base, you know, and that can fail, and so you don't want to have another definitive method. You don't want to have another completely separate module, try it, like you
and
said, kind of in the same way,
yeah, yeah.
And yeah, you
yeah.
know, which one is right there.
Yes.
So you have this right brain that is looking at it, checking its memory for whether or not that looks right, all these sorts of things that you talked about, and you get a whole different verification.
The memory part, I think, is especially interesting, what you said. You know Marvin Minsky? Do you know the name? Marvin, I'm, you know, my PhD is in computer science. I don't know if you know that.
Mm.
I never had a psychology course in my life. Not quite, but more or less. It's true. I never had a course in psychology. But I was working in artificial intelligence. My PhD is in computer science.
Mm-hmm.
But my dissertation was done in biology. When will we say that a computer is intelligent? And there were many landmarks. I mean, one of them was to play checkers. I remember before I even graduated in college, there was some people said checkers. And then there were computers who play games, computers who could easily beat you in checkers. Then there was chess. When I was a graduate student, computers did not beat grandmasters in chess. Then Blue 2, you know, now he's the world champion,
mm-hmm.
right? Beat the humans. So that it passed. So does that mean computers are conscious? No, intelligent, yeah, no, we programmed it in, it's not the same. So Jeopardy. Now the computer is winning Jeopardy. Why is Jeopardy such an important test? It seems much more trivial than chess. No, it's because it incorporates common sense, knowledge about the world, and knowledge about language in pragmatic context. Not just the logical meaning of words, but how do you use them in everyday situations, and how do you hint, and what humor is, and stuff like that, you know. It learns from experience. That's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that computers are definitely intelligent. Are they conscious? Yeah, in principle they are. Could they be conscious? I mean, they may not be very conscious yet, but in principle I don't see any problem. Why? What do I mean by that? What are the criteria that would make a computer conscious? First of all, the test, you know, I think we mentioned it last time we talked, the common test that computer scientists had for a computer being intelligent, you know, conscious, was the Turing test.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you type something in, you get a response back. If you cannot differentiate the machine from a person, it passed the Turing test. If you think, hey, that's not human, you know, I interact, it answers appropriately, it asks me questions, it develops the topic, you know, in novel ways, so it passed the test. Now, we tend to think about it differently, some people. They think about it more in terms of emotions and empathy. That's what Blade Runner does. That's why I like that. That's why I teach that. Blade Runner is a movie I do in my class.
Yeah.
It's about consciousness. That's what the movie is about, I think. I mean, that's what I use it for, right? Right. What makes an android different from a human? Emotions. I mean, the beginning of the test is the pupil test. Remember the empathy test?
Mm-hmm.
The guy sits there, you know, there's an android. Somebody suspects him, Leon is suspecting him of being an android. So the one of the Blade Runner guys is testing him, you know, giving him a psychological test. He sits there and he tells him, you're in a desert and you see a turtle turn on its back. What are you going to do? How do you feel about that? Android has begun. He's very intelligent. I mean, he knows a lot, but he doesn't feel. So he says, what do you mean, desert? What's a turtle? You know. But then he says, they don't get very far, so the psychologist says to him, give me the first thing that comes to your mind when I say, your mother. What about my mother? How do you feel? Here's how I feel about my mother. And he shoots him. Because he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know what to say. They have some memories built into them, but those memories are not really part of their experience yet, other than integrating them in time. When I was in artificial intelligence, I remember there was a well-known MIT guy called Marvin Minsky, still around, very influential in artificial intelligence and computer science. And I remember reading an article, 1962, 63, about how a computer, in what sense a computer can have self-consciousness. And the article was very straightforward. You have a model of the computer in its own program. So you differentiate in the program that guides the robot, the computer, the part that describes the environment and the part that describes its own competence. And then it plans its actions knowing what it can do relative to what the environment is at the same time. So basically this is an internal representation of the self, and that is one condition that you want to associate with consciousness. So I said already, feelings, I said representation of the self, can expand it to a sense of past, present, and future, you know, a continuous thing. And then problem solving, you want him to, you know, adaptive problem solving, really, you know, novel, you know, not something that would be programmed in a simple way, right? Thermostats, you know, can respond to the environment, but not in very interesting ways. And then there is the extra thing, right? The hard problem.
Yeah.
The qualia thing. And so I wave my hand. I think, I don't know, I mean, maybe I really love philosophy, and I really used to read a lot of it and talk to philosophers. But recently, I've not done some much technical reading in philosophy.
That's good practice.
Yeah. So I mean, it seems to me, qualia is really it's exactly the opposite from what it seems. Qualia seems to be referring to this immediate experience, and therefore to something that we cannot know about unless we are the person who experiences it.
Mm-hmm.
No. Maybe qualia is my cognizing about my sensory experience. It's precisely my awareness of the sensory experience that makes it special. I can go around and I notice that this is purple, but I don't attend to it. But now I attend to it. What does that mean? I'm conscious of the fact that it's purple. What does that mean? I'm just directing my attention to that. That becomes the center of my processing. So I bring this into the object I'm processing, but I'm processing about it and I'm processing things about it. So it seems to me maybe qualia is simply my second level, meta level analysis of the object language, in which case is the sensory experience itself.
So what do you think then? Because that also would, like you said, describe self-awareness, you know, introspection
exactly.
on your own
exactly.
conditions,
exactly.
And then we're sort of introspecting on our own experience
yes.
of this color.
Yes.
But what do you say is the difference, if there is one, between, say a more advanced Watson, the Jeopardy computer,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
say however many years from now it further develops its level of comprehension, its ability to adapt. What is the difference between when the the signal, the light waves from this cup interact with Watson versus when they interact with me, where it's, you know, it's difficult to say, even if I were able to fully Turing communicate with Watson and ask it about its experience, I would still have a lot of difficulty saying that its experience of that color is equivalent to mine.
Why?
Because of the hard problem that it is, it seems to me that whatever it is that I'm capable of doing, it comes down to even the way we're talking about it, that we're saying, I experience this color, I do that. Up until now, Watson isn't able to do that.
It's not instructed. He doesn't care to do that. You know, we can program it to do that.
But that's different.
No, it's not. We've been programmed to do that. Come on.
Well,
evolution has programmed us. What's the difference?
I agree. I agree that this has developed over time, and I see no problem in principle as to why our neural activity can't be replicated in a machine, but I question whether the algorithm that allows Watson to answer these mm-hmm. questions mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. quote unquote comprehend, mm-hmm. if that is alone sufficient for.
You say the key word is algorithm. It's not an algorithm. We said it's an algorithm. It's a method. It's a heuristic. It's not an algorithm. You know, in computer science, you're making the distinction between problems that have a solution. You know you're going to get to the solution this way. That's an algorithm. And a heuristic. You use an approach that will get you more or less close to the solution.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's an algorithm. And neither mine nor his needs to be an algorithm. You know, it's just a way of getting closer to the solution. That's, you know, really an important point. When I was in computer science, my advisor was very hands-on. He was formerly a mathematical logician, and he was in industry for a while. Really great ideas he had. I did not agree with him on the theoretical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I felt he believed that computers could never be conscious in exactly the sense that you're saying. Because consciousness is not algorithmic, and you know there is a sense in which Gödel's proof shows that there is a limit to how much mathematics can actually express
mm-hmm.
about our intuitions, about truth, and so on. Big philosophical problem, and therefore computers are not conscious. And this is what we are doing, is not trying to implement something like consciousness or even human intelligence in a sense. I really disagreed with that. I mean, it's not that I questioned what he says. I questioned the goal or the vision that he had, or he was kind of I was betraying him. It's like a love affair that we, you know, like you have some kind of this professor and his student. You had to to commit yourself to that thing.
Uh-huh.
But I did not. I mean, I respected him, but I did not believe that stuff. You know, it was really bad. I had to leave. I left. I had to.
Really?
Yeah, it was really bad. It was the most traumatic time in my life until then. And so I was lucky. My wife was working in another department of the school with a really good, interesting team. And I said to the team, they're in biology. What do they know about language, you know, and stuff? Can I show you how to do science, you know? Very arrogant. I didn't say that, but I thought, you know. Language in the two hemispheres. I'm gonna tell you how to find out how much language there is in the two hemispheres. They were working on the split brain. And I was going to find out how much language there is in the right hemisphere, because the correct way, you know, and how much is in the left, and what's going on. And the professor, really well-known guy, says to me, how are you going to study it? And I said, this way, I had an idea. And he said, I don't think it's going to work. But he gave me the money. And he did not tell me what to do day in, day out, the way my professor in computer science did.
Mm-hmm.
He let me be. And it worked. I was lucky, and it worked. The point is, I could not work without the belief that something is, you know, that I can achieve something with a certain approach. You know what I mean? You know, practically, why couldn't I work with my professor in computer science? I couldn't. It was something about that commitment to the idea that there is an in principle obstacle from us expressing, you know, our consciousness in a way that a computer can acquire it. I just didn't accept. I couldn't. It's no. I'm sorry. I don't believe mm-hmm. that. I think, you know, you're right that maybe computers are not conscious now, but I think that with giving them some evolution in the sense of social interaction, feelings,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to have.
That's that. That I can agree with. Because, like I said, to me, there's no restriction to neurons. It doesn't have to be neurons, you know?
Right.
Anything that can do what neurons can do can do consciousness.
Yes. You think better than us, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Good point. And so maybe it's just a matter of not having reached enough complexity. I mean, all these neurons, they synapse on millions of
yes.
other neurons. They
yes.
release
yes.
variable amounts of neurotransmitter,
yes.
and the,
yes.
the signaling is perhaps a bit different than the way our computers work in whatever binary fashion. But I guess, what was my point here? So maybe...
You're agreeing with me now. I mean, you're agreeing with me that in principle there is none, but you think that there is something that would prevent that principle from something else.
No. Okay, here's what I was going to say. I think that maybe the method of getting there is so far too ingrained in the mechanism that we're using. So because we have to use computers,
right.
we're designing systems that
yes.
are limited in the same way as
yes.
you know, being on or off or,
yes,
or
yes.
working in this way.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it might be that would help even further differentiate from using strict algorithms,
right.
which is probably what these systems have to rely on, into having a more flexible, like you said, heuristic. And so maybe that's sort of our problem. Like, maybe we should be modeling variability better.
I think we have been. In mathematics, in computer science, people have been doing it for a while. You know, the idea of fuzzy sets is exactly that. So the idea of a fuzzy set is expressing a concept has exactly that thing about a graded boundary. It's not a well-defined thing, it's a graded boundary. No, they've been trying to do that for a long time. To look at heuristics as opposed to algorithms and incorporate both. And, you know, the reason computers were so good at doing things, play chess or even Jeopardy, is that they incorporated human strategies into them.
Mm-hmm.
Grandmasters were part of the programming team, and they put in all kinds of strategies that human beings use. Analogy,
yeah,
because
it's not a set rule. You can either
yeah.
be aggressive in certain parts or
yeah.
be more defensive.
And right, and you look at a corner and do this. What that? I mean, what, you know, you just... People, you know, oh, they did an experiment. That's a really interesting experiment I read about. This woman is looking at the brains of experts in various fields.
Mm-hmm.
She took grandmasters. Now, she took, I think, anyway, one grandmaster, I don't remember, and imaged, and she told the chess experts to do the following problem. I'm going to show you a board position, a difficult board position. Think of your next move. And she imaged the brain. Brilliant idea, because she's taking in just the right creative moment. She's not waiting for it to happen. She's forcing them to be in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Really good idea. Which part of the brain was working, do you think?
I think I heard of this experiment. It's the facial recognition.
Unbelievable, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the facial recognition area, which many people some people in human research believe is a skill area, where you recognize something very well. Not only faces, but other patterns that are common, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In any case, they recognize it as a face, you know, as one, you know, as a gestalt that incorporates a whole bunch of relationships that are not articulated in terms of, at least we think, may not be articulated in terms of all or none relations, but in terms of set membership. I mean, what makes a person be the member of the family? Nose is a bit similar, the eyes are similar, in the sister and the brother have a similar nose and mouth, the mother and the have a similar eye and nose, you know. There's enough overlap to make you a member of the family, but it's never exactly the same set.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fuzzy, you know.
It's a fuzzy set.
A family, yeah, it's a fuzzy set. It's a family relationship. Wittgenstein talked about that, of course, a lot, you know. So, I mean, yeah, it's very interesting. She's not doing it by just reasoning. She's gets a whole gestalt that incorporates a whole bunch of things. Feelings, probably, and knowing how to act in a certain way, and oh, it's fascinating, and it's not simple, but it is something that can presumably be gained through experience, and presumably by having emotional experience, it's going to be strengthened and bolstered by alternative strategies, and by having motor experience, you're going to make it very strong. You know, people now talk about embodied cognition, that action is really important when you understand language, for example. So you image the brain of a person when he says, I kicked a habit, and then the foot area is active. You know, why? What is it? You know, it's a metaphor, but no, it's there. And
yeah, I think the you know, adoption of it's a module. That's probably one of the more delineated specific modules, and that, you know, if you it's
face area, you mean?
Yeah, it's actually specific to things. Because I remember, I don't know if it was in the same study or the same video I saw, that they had some other examples. So there's this kid who, I don't know if maybe he was autistic and had some deficit in the
mm-hmm,
facial recognition
mm-hmm.
part,
mm-hmm.
but it had been completely overtaken by these like cartoon characters that he was fascinated by. And, mm-hmm. and you know, there's like a huge bank of these cartoon characters, and then he knew their names and their qualities,
right.
and being shown one of them activated that thing.
The same area. No,
yeah.
I didn't know that. No,
yeah.
I did not know that. There is an object area that is distinct from the face area. We know that. I mean, people have shown that there is a face area and an object area, and they're not the same thing in the brain, you know. When,
oh.
Yeah, so, I mean, in his case, maybe he's moving one
yeah,
to the other.
Yeah, he had identified a specific object, and then it seems like it translated,
into
okay, now this object, move
yes.
it over here, and let's
yes,
figure
yes,
it out
yes, yes,
fully.
Yes.
Because there's a kid who had the same thing with cars, the identification
of cars. Cows is another one. I mean, recognizing, you know, farmers who lose face recognition sometimes lose the ability to recognize their own cows, you know. You know, recognizing the face of a cow is pretty difficult. You're not used to
it's
it.
Good skill. Okay, so my next step, I guess, is having sort of agreed that there is no in principle difficulty in
mm-hmm.
reproducing consciousness or you know, developing consciousness. How do you think it differs? Because for me, just to tell you a bit about what I think is that, you know, say now the machine can do qualia. You know, we've made it sufficiently similar or
mm-hmm.
functionally similar to
yes.
our brains that can do that. Is there something different it's doing than what we do? Because I tend to believe that consciousness is different than everything else in the universe. It's my opinion that the subjective experience, whether or not we restrict it to humans now, we've opened it to everything, that subjective experience is a unique feature of the universe. And I'd like to know what you think consciousness is now that we've learned or decided that we can make it.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure what you mean by a unique feature of the universe. It sounds a bit mysterious. I mean, you know.
Let me explain.
Okay.
Let me explain a little more. So the distinction comes with the subjectivity of it.
Yeah.
That these are everything else is you know, an objective thing, that you know, this substance is hard, it has these properties, but when I or another conscious thing experiences those things, that it's different than what the universe does alone. That the way the universe interacts with itself and based on these rules, and I think there is a separate set of rules that governs conscious things, and that they, in the same way that, you know, gravity governs this item falling, that there are certain rules for which, you know, that regulate the way consciousness operates, and that should we be able to create something that's conscious, that it would be because there are these rules for things of this, you know, things that work this way. So for neurons that reach a certain complexity, or for devices that reach this complexity, that they now operate under conscious rules.
Right. I mean, I hope you're wrong. No, I believe exactly the opposite, I think. I believe that there is consciousness is definitely a state that an organism can reach, and that it means nothing but the ability to metacognize about certain experiences. And, you know, to the extent that my colleague does not do that. He does not think about it. You know, you said before, how many, you know, people don't tend to usually sit there and think about the problems we're going to talk about today. They may experience them, you know, as part of watching a movie or something. And I don't, yeah, sure, but I mean, to that extent, my colleague may not be conscious as much as conscious as I am, or I may be less conscious than somebody else. And
what I'm referring to more is that we all, regardless of whether we think about it or know about it, we all have subjective personal experiences. So just as for me, this is my current experience, for you, it's of this, you know, and the fact that we are sort of individuals and that we have these experiences, I think is different than everything else.
I don't know why you're saying that. It's possible. I mean, other things being equal, I'm going to assume that the world is simple, not complex.
Okay.
Why do I want to assume that there's a separate set of rules for that level if I can explain it with the existing set of rules? And I'm going to try to do that.
I understand that. So maybe it's not that it's completely separate. I guess I don't mean to go too far, but I think there's a difference between subjective experience and things that are not subjective. So we are subjective. Animals are subjective, though they tend to access this to a lesser extent than we do, right. and some things may do it more.
Yes, exactly. It comes in degrees. Absolutely. Yeah, right.
What does it mean? What does it mean for me to exist? For there to be an individual that is experiencing something?
It means that your cognition applies not only to being able to respond to situations in an appropriately, in an innate, predetermined way, but you have the ability to represent the environment, including your feelings and your sensory experience, and to be able to do things with it. Maybe just feel it. I mean, what's the difference between what you're saying and feelings? That's true about feelings, what you're saying. You know, the subjective thing, when I feel sad, I mean, there need not be anything in the external world that makes me go into that state, right? There's something internal that makes me sad. Now, is that something that I would require to be a part of consciousness? Yeah, possibly. In that, do I therefore need to move into a different state in the universe? No. It's just that certain configuration of situation of neurons that work in a certain way, that my limbic system is getting so much input from that, so much input from that, and just happens to make me sad now. I mean,
I think we could extract emotion. And the key, or one of the key features of being conscious, is this self-awareness. And so, like you said, it can be just this introspection or
a representation
of yourself.
Yeah.
But I think that subjective experience is still different. It's still...
I know what you're saying. You're saying that when we process a model of ourselves in an abstract way. So here's I just did an experiment in social psychology, and I see some things about my self-concept. And I see, hey, it looks like, in fact, I'm going to have a questionnaire. This is a really interesting thing to do. Not many people do that. In a group of people who are together, maybe in my lab, let everybody fill out a questionnaire about what they think about each other. And then anonymously show it to everybody. I think it would be fascinating to find out what people think about each other and how I am perceived by other people. That's part of my self-concept. And that's going to determine to some extent how I feel and how I interact. So I don't deny that there is a sense in which my awareness of things can change. You know, I can be more in touch, less in touch, work on it in an abstract way, or get more emotionally involved. That's just part of the interaction of the system. More limbic system, less limbic system, you know, more metacognition, less metacognition. You see, your formulation itself is really useful, really important in one way, it seems to me. Here's the problem. How do we explain that mathematics works in the world? Let me put it this way. A mathematician develops a theory about groups. Physicists, some years later, try to explain some physical phenomena, and it turns out that group theory explains it really well. What the hell is that all about? Why does mathematics fit the world? What's going on? This is abstract stuff that some mathematicians sit sits at home and thinks it through. And it has nothing to do with real life. I would even imagine situations, I know they exist, where some, we can talk about that sometime, but I mean, some logician is now coming up with a theorem that nobody else is going to read, or if they read it, they wouldn't understand it. So let's decide that he's going to discover a theorem now that nobody else knows about. Has he discovered something new about the world? Is he more conscious about the world? I mean, what has he changed about the world? And now let's suppose that somebody does find out about that and uses it to model some kind of a piece of a new computer that we're going to build from non-carbon stuff, I don't know. And it turns out to be very useful. Why? Why did it work? You know what I mean? It's really amazing. It's the problem of the philosophy of mathematics. I mean, you know, the only answer I can come up with is the brain is coming up with both. The mathematics comes from this. We see the world through this, and there's something in common. Now, I don't know if it's Platonic ideals, you know, so that exist outside there independently of, because our brains can only conceive of it, and that's it, or something, but all of us do conceive some, I don't know, but there is something about the universality that you're suggesting that is appealing, you know, because it can explain some things that I don't see how else they would work. But, it has to be material. I'm a materialist, you know.
I wouldn't say I'm not a materialist.
Yeah.
I'm saying that the universe, because it, I cannot deny that the universe contains consciousness.
Why do you say that? That's a very strange thing to say. Look, why? That's a very strange sentence.
The universe contains rules, or the universe is rules. It is regulated by these rules that govern how pieces operate.
Yeah.
And among those, and I guess this stems sort of from the way that I perceive subjectivity to be different.
In special.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. And that's why I say that the universe contains consciousness too. That the objective rules maybe don't define further rules for consciousness, but within the rules that allow for you know particles to interact are rules that eventually lead to consciousness.
In other words, there is some special constraints on the rules that govern electrons and things that actually constitute consciousness.
Or not that they're special, or not that consciousness breaks any of those rules.
No, not breaks, just more. It's
yes.
More than that.
For the same reason that I tend to believe that right now we're not terribly close to consciousness, but in theory, a machine that perfectly replicates my brain would be just as conscious as I am.
Yes.
So I think that there's certain interactions in the brain that are modeled by the same rules that govern everything else,
yes.
But then there's something different that's happening, and
special.
Yeah, something special. And if you are able to create this same model in the
then
same way with different things that you would use the rules within the universe.
Consciousness.
Yeah, to access consciousness.
Right. And I'm saying that I don't need to posit anything special about that. I'm arguing that it's precisely the same rules that allow me to cognize about other things that allow me to...
When you say allow me to cognize, these are things that to me seem uniquely subjective.
No, not at all. That allow the computer to operate on some information. Very, very, very specific. The same rules that allow the computer to operate, so the robot has to move a set of blocks from here to here.
Uh-huh.
It has a representation of the environment, and the environment is a space that's big. No, it knows about its steps. It can move this. It can push something this way. It can plan a sequence of operations that will solve the problem. Now, the computer can have a more detailed information, so it knows about what it can do in the sense that it knows what its move. But it can have a slightly more interesting model of itself. It can have something like that says, I'm going to be better if somebody's going to oil me or something once a week, you know, right? I feel better, you know, sex, I don't know, you know. So I'm going to feel better if I have a certain experience every week, right? I'm going to be even better when I... will have a set of feelings, you know, something that will give me priorities when I create certain actions. For example, self-preservation is a really good thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily feel that way now, but if I do, it will be more effective because then I'll be more efficient. I'll keep resources better. I'm not sure.
But to me, using the word "I" in that context assumes subjectivity.
No. The computer, I did not mean that. Are you seeing?
Yeah, I don't know why I have so much difficulty with that.
You may be right that I'm hiding. You're arguing that my use of that language hides a whole kind of lots of baggage that I'm not making explicit otherwise.
I think that there's so much more to my experience that I don't require anything necessarily magical. I think that
I think that
ultimately those principles that
will
allow, you know, that define what it is required for consciousness, those can be discovered. We can find that. But I still think that...
That's special. That's what you say. And they're separate. And you're not saying that not material. You're not saying, but you're saying that we are.
That is basically my point. It is that consciousness is special, and that to reduce it too far, I think, does it a disservice.
I don't know. A disservice. I mean,
it's very special to be conscious.
You know.
You disagree.
Maybe it's too highly rated somehow. You know, I don't know. You know, you can be self preoccupied and then, you know, you can do nothing. You know, you can think about what you're thinking and you think about what you're thinking or thinking, and yeah, God help us. I mean, you know, where do you get with that? Can be, you know, to be too self preoccupied or to be self directed, you know, inwardly directed. No, something very bad, you know, it's very bad for you. You may be right. I don't think so. At least I may be missing something. I really may be missing something. I mean, Searle or some philosopher will show this. I'm making a logical contradiction somewhere. I don't see it yet. Maybe I'm far enough now. I mean, I don't feel... Look, the problem of other minds. How can I possibly know what you're feeling now, right? What is your subjective experience right now? No way for me to know, right?
Right.
Not true. It's not true. I mean, you're going to suppose you now... will smile. And suppose there's a mirror neuron associated with smiling. Let's just suppose that. I will now activate the same neurons that I will use when I smile. I'll share experience with you. It may not be identical, but it'll be a lot in common. Part of your subjective experience is shared with mine. And it's shared by the fact that I can act, that I can respond in a way that I would when I act in the same way. So I don't. There's nothing magical about that. You know.
I trust that you now are having subjective experiences. You're thinking about what I'm saying and maybe other things and what you see and
yes.
I can't confirm that. For all I know, you could be a zombie or something.
Right,
but
very smart zombie. Right? I mean, you know, that's.
But I still trust that. Your subjective experience is no weaker than mine, no less interesting, no less unique, and makes you who you are.
Yeah. I know. Don't bribe me. I mean, in other words, don't, you know, so what? You know, say I'm conscious. So what? I mean, that does not mean that I'm special or that I'm in a special state. I want to be able, look, other things being equal, I would like to express my subjective state now as a part of the physiological system that I have and the complexity of the computation that I have, and I don't see why it needs an extra special state. I may be wrong, but I don't see that. I really don't see that. It seems to me just another part of representing yourself when you're in your actions. And you're just cognizing about it means you're now looking at the emotions and seeing what they are and you're re-experiencing them in some sense, right? You're re-experiencing them not by engaging them, but by imagining them. We know that you can engage the visual cortex not by only by seeing, but by imagining the scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weaker representation of the same areas. You know, so, I mean...
No, that's true, because what I was saying is that, you know, there will ultimately be some mechanism for it, and then that can be explained.
Yes,
so,
so
I think maybe more of the difficulty I'm having is what could that mechanism be? And it could very well be exactly what you're saying,
yeah.
And that it's just a difficult subject to tackle,
right?
Because just maybe because of the way we have to attack it from within,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or something like that.
Right. I guess I really believe that it's an emergent property of the complexity of the system. In a sense, you know, just the more metacognizing you have in different levels and back and forth and stuff, you'll have essentially what we think is consciousness. I think.
Uh huh.
I think that's all it is.
Yeah, I mean, if we go back a few evolutionary steps to, like, a fish or something, it has some volition, you know,
yes.
it goes up to the top and eats,
yes.
and then poops and does all these
things. And it enjoys some things, it seems. And,
yeah.
And, you know, it's more than that. It turns out hemispheric specialization, you know, it's really a strange thing. In us, it's kind of strong. Apes, not that strong, apparently.
Really?
Monkeys, not much. Rats, fish, and chicken have huge hemispheric specialization. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, chicken have one hemisphere as avoidance and one hemisphere as approach. It's incredible. Neurochemically, physiologically, anatomically, behaviorally, really amazing. Fish, too. Really strong hemispheric differences. Partly maybe because they don't have a corpus callosum or something. The separation is stronger.
Oh, they don't?
They don't.
They have a cerebrum?
Yeah. I mean, they have some kind of a, something like optic tectum, you know,
tegmentum,
stuff. You know, another archaic visual system in us that allows, the one that we use in the periphery for detecting changes in brightness and movement, and quick things. You know, sometimes you look at a television set, you don't see the lines, right? But you look here, now you see them.
Yeah.
Because it's only, you see it in the periphery. That's the second system, the other system. And it's a system that may be not involving consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm coming to that thing. So, I mean, there are ways, of course, to process information with and without awareness. What does that mean? It means it will be something that I can cognize about or something like that. It's not available for me. So if I have a metacognitive system that receives input, it will not receive input during those states. So I can process some information with and without that input.
Unfortunately, we had to end the interview early for Dr. Zeidel to prepare for class. But I really appreciate his time, and I think we had a great talk.